Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 169 featuring Rob Redman, who is, one of the main editors over at 3D World. And I was very fortunate to be able to sit down with him because I was at the Vertex Conference, which is a conference that was run by a combination of 3D World and 3D Artist Magazine. 3D Artist, obviously, Carrie was part of that. But, you know, because they were so busy, I still was able to sit down with Rob and record a quick podcast, which I think is really cool. I'm really fascinated by journalism in our field and how they're able to understand what people are interested in. There's a lot of stuff that's interesting. You know, obviously you would think that they just want to see the big glitz and glamour, but really a lot of people want to get under the hood and find out things. It's much more like an automotive magazine if you really think about it that way, where it's my, you know, tips and tricks on how to get your hot rod working. I find it really interesting. The whole idea of what makes people interested in finding out more about technology and about visual effects and computer graphics. So really, really cool stuff that we had there. And I really want to thank both Carrie and Rob for having me at the Vertex conference. It was really interesting to be there. I really appreciate it. I had a really great time, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens next year, because it could grow even bigger. So really excited to be there. Thanks so much. I have another story I have to tell before I get to announcements. I just forgot. Last week on my previous podcast intro, I was talking about events, and I was talking about the THU conference, because the last podcast was recorded at THU. And I mentioned that the new location of THU will be in Malta. That information is correct. However, because I'm an idiot, I said that Malta is a small island in the middle of the Pacific. And now a lot of you guys are laughing, which I understand. I meant Mediterranean. So I have dyslexia, as some of you may know, but obviously my dyslexia has extended to the geography. And I'm very well aware of where Malta is. It's not in the Pacific, it's in the Mediterranean. Okay. Back to where I was talking about. Speaking of events, this is announcements. You guys may know about Total Chaos. We've mentioned it several times before. That is our own conference that is happening in Sofia, May 18th and 19th. I'd love to see you guys there. So if you want more information, go to chaosgroup.com and check out events. Other events that you may see listed there is FMX. That's happening in April, end of April. And we'll be doing our V-Ray days there. So lots of exciting speakers. I don't know off the top of my head. I can't remember who they are specifically, but our page will tell you that. So go to chaosgroup.com, check out the events section, and you will see what's going on in FMX. Really love to see you guys there. But even sooner than that, in fact, happening right as the podcast comes out, the podcast comes out and we will be at NAB. If you guys are interested in finding out more about what's going on at in V-Ray Cloud, I'm sure you guys would be interested in finding out about it and seeing what it looks like and see how our implementation of our cloud implementation has been working. Go to the Google booth at NAB, and we will be presenting over there. Lon and David will be there, and I'm sure they'd love to show stuff. Tell them you love the podcast, by the way. Just say, Chris is not here. It's too bad, because I really love the podcast. Just tell them that, because it's just going to drive them nuts. Anyway, that's all I can say about that. So go check that out. Any other announcements I want to make? I don't think so. The only other thing I'd say is, you know, I've kind of stopped saying it, but I want to remind one last time that remember to like and subscribe our stuff. I really would like to get more information from you, more feedback. So if you're on Facebook, go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast, all one word. And you can write a review there. You can tell us some ideas. Love to hear more ideas and stuff there. If you're not on Facebook and you don't want to, or you want to listen to this podcast on iTunes, go ahead and go into iTunes and let us know what you think there. Give us a review, rate us. I would love to know more about that. And otherwise, you know, just send us an email. There's always in that way you can do it, which is labs@chaosgroup.com. And you can just send an email there. Love to hear from you. And that's about it. With that, I want you to enjoy this great podcast with Rob Redman from 3D World Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays In high dynamic range, we know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
What gave you guys this idea to do this conference?
I think there's been a lack in London and the UK generally of kind of broad scope visual effects, CG and animation events. So there are some companies that have got kind of small, very niche things. So there are like studios like Escape Studios, they have mm-hmm. their own event, Blue GFX, they have something, but they're not kind of all encompassing. And we wanted to bring together all parts of the industry in the UK and some, you know, Europeans to come together and just kind of celebrate what we do in a slightly broader, larger way and let everybody kind of have their say.
Well, that's interesting because the UK is so important, you know, in terms of that market. And obviously there's a lot of CG done here. So, you know, it's one of the biggest markets in the world. And I'm surprised why do you think that happened? Do you think it was just because people got too busy, they didn't think about it, or?
I don't know, to be honest. I think being such a small country, maybe we're all kind of in the mindset of going, well, let's all fly to LA and Vancouver and go to Seagraph.
So you were looking at it as a vacation.
Well, no, not so much that. As a, you know, why would Hollywood decamp to come to London? But actually, like you say, we've got Framestore, The Mill.
You've got all the big names. Right.
And London and the area generally have such a rich history of filmmaking, not just visual effects, but they're all tied together so closely that there's a massive support network here. And why it just kind of came to us and we were like, why wouldn't we make the most of that?
Well, I think what's also interesting to me about London and about, you know, about the UK is, you know, if you think about all the different visual effects industries, and I know Scott's going to talk about a little bit about some of the Brexit stuff, et cetera. But if you think about, you know, obviously California was one of the first places in terms of visual effects that you're going to have, you know, the ILMs, the DDs, the Rhythm and Hues back in the day, et cetera, that were based in California. And then, you know, because of the tax subsidies, et cetera, London formed itself and Vancouver formed itself. But London did something very different compared to other places, is they started their own studios here, right? Framestore is a UK company from the start, right? Yeah. And The Mill is definitely one of the, you know, and they're one of the best, as well as Double Negative and all the other.
You've got MPC.
MPC so and you know, The Mill is incredible work, et cetera. Really, really top quality. But these are UK-started companies. These are not sort of satellite companies. Because you see what's happening in Vancouver. Most of those are satellite companies in a lot of ways. And not to say that that's a good or bad thing. But just the idea that the UK, you know, said, okay, if we're going to make visual effects here, we're going to do it from our own birth, right? Start from the UK. What do you think inspired people to do that, or what enabled that to happen?
I think this probably harks back to the history of filmmaking. So you've got the big studios that are all within, you know, kind of 15 miles of Soho.
Mm-hmm.
Soho is a good place for visual effects to be made logistically.
Okay, so why is that?
I think you've got the reach of, well, there's 11 million people that live in London. Mm-hmm. So you've got an awfully big pool of talent that you can draw upon. Some may want to move in from other locations, but you've got the housing, you've got the support, you've got bandwidth for data movement, you've got all that kind of stuff. So that tied into the fact that people have that nostalgic element of, well, this film was made here. And then as soon as you get a film like, just taking as an example, Harry Potter,
mm-hmm.
well, you start off with that one film and you put all the legwork in and all the groundwork, and then you've got that whole franchise to continue.
Right.
So I think there's probably some of that as well. There have been a lot of big franchises that have been made, at least in part, in London.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back a long way.
Yeah. It has. I mean, obviously, Pinewood has a massive history, right? Its history is as important as any of the big studios in Hollywood as well. But really, when I think of, you know, Pinewood, I know that it's obviously been in a lot of films, but I think of the fact that it was used for some of the first sort of bigger films that came out of the 70s, like the Star Wars and, you know, those types of films, or Alien or things of like that. I think there's something that's always had a little bit of that sci-fi-ness to it.
And even as a location, when you walk around the studios, you have these massive great aircraft style hangars and things, and it just lends itself. And I mean, that's part of filmmaking. That's Paramount's the same. You walk around and it's kind of these immense buildings. And you can't get away from that, and it kind of sets itself in your mind. So,
you know, the other thing that was interesting to me is I was at the Bake Off, not this year, but last year. This year was may have been similar, but last year I went there. And, you know, have you been to the Bake Offs before or at all? Okay, so the just so their audience knows what it is, the Bake Off is the last, it's the first, there's a committee inside the academy that's based for the visual effects. And a subset of that committee takes literally every film that ever had some kind of visual effects representation and nominates 10 movies out of that to be considered for an Oscar. And then those 10 movies go to what's called a Bake Off, and anyone can attend a Bake Off, but more importantly, anyone who's a member of the visual effects branch of the Academy has to attend, and they get to vote on the top movies, which narrows it down from 10 to 5, right? So your 5 movies are then presented at the Oscars, and the entire Academy then votes on which one is the best one of those 5. But when you go to the Bake Offs, all 10 movies have to be presented to the audience, and then there needs to be someone that talks about what was done, and they have a few, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever their limit they're given to do their presentation. Almost everyone had a British accent, meaning there are so many Brits in this area, and it's seeing more and more and more of that, to the point where I'm like, okay, well, it's not just about that movies are being done in England. I think that obviously the British have actually really sort of integrated themselves into this world of the visual effects industry. And I've seen many, many great, great people, leaders and visual effects supervisors who have done that. I think there's a real history here. What about the education system? What is the education system supporting this in a lot of ways?
Yes and no, I think. Or no, the answer is yes. Okay. But I think there are some pitfalls. And so as I go around talking to studios and to universities, I find that...
And I do want to talk about... I do want to come back and talk about how you get... Because you get to talk to everyone, right? As a press guy. So I want to get to talking to that. But yeah, tell me what you think about universities.
So I think there is a lot of support there. There are many around the country that have computer science or visual effects or animation courses. Mm-hmm. So they're all there. I think the problem that most studios seem to find is that they're so far ahead of the game when it comes to specific skills, it's quite hard for the universities to keep up sometimes.
To keep up, right.
So they will do a fantastic degree course, but over that 3 years, they will teach a set of skills. And then those people will leave their school and they'll try and get a job. And the skills that they have don't necessarily match what the studio is looking for at that time.
Right.
So there are people that are trying to do things slightly different. So you've got Anim Dojo from Blue Box, and you've got from Tom Box, and you've got various things that are trying to fill very niche gaps. And this isn't just training, but I think this is also from a vendor perspective. So Andy Serkis, for example, has his the Imaginarium, which is a motion capture studio. So I think when you go and you break it down and you look at the skills needed, there's a kind of a two-way approach to it. So you have smaller studios with more specific requirements, which is probably easier to fill because you can train on the job because the skill sets last longer. And then you've got the universities who are training generalists, who then need to either sideline their training and come in from a different angle, and they'll need extra support, or they'll go into being runners and they'll get some experience that way. And that's a whole other kettle of fish. And then there's the politics as well.
Well, I don't necessarily think it's a good idea for studios to do, or for schools to teach something specific. Like if you said, here's exactly how to use this piece of software, that's pointless. Because I know, like, exactly the software that we work in V-Ray.
Yeah.
If I taught everyone exactly how to use V-Ray right now, within a year, everything they learn will be useless,
yeah,
or fairly useless, right? So the schools, I think the responsibility of schools should be to make people generalists, because that's the only way. Now, it's not necessarily going to get you the specific job that you need, but if the studios saw that and says, okay, now I have to invest in this person in somehow, because
yes,
I got to get them in because I know they're talented, right? And then from there we'll grow. I think that, or find the right place. And that's probably what can do. I think there's a lot that the studios could learn from hiring talent above skill.
Yeah. Yeah, completely agree.
Yeah.
And also finding somebody with the right attitude, yes, is far more important than finding someone who knows what button to press.
Yeah, absolutely. Button pressers is just sad if that's all we become, yeah, right?
And I see so many reels that come in and you go, well, they followed that tutorial from YouTube or this one, or
oh,
you know,
gosh,
they're a duplicate. And,
right.
Oh, look, there's another Andrew Kramer.
Right. Know. Yeah, it's true. It's true. But let's since we're talking about education, let's talk about the role that you guys do. So you obviously working for FutureNet, right?
Yes.
And you guys put out two publications.
We did.
That are very well received. There's 3D Artists and 3D World. Both of those sort of showcase a lot of stuff that's both inspirational and educational to a lot of people.
Absolutely.
And they are very important to do that. And in fact, I've contributed a few pieces myself to that, which is really nice to be able to be a contributor to the magazines. What do you think the role of the press is in our industry? What do you think our audiences want to hear?
As much as I have the task of kind of driving the focus of 3D World, and Carrie has the same at 3D Artist, mm-hmm, I think I also have a bit of a responsibility. So I could make the magazine, I could shape it into whatever I wanted it to be within reason, you know, mm-hmm, as long as I keep my industry focus. Mm-hmm. But I think the feedback that I get from readers and my experience over 12 years as a reader of that magazine myself,
right,
just means that I want to kind of find the right balance. I want people come to the magazine for tutorials a lot. That's one of the
right,
big focuses. People, they want to sit down and they want to be able to follow a tutorial step by step and learn how to either recreate something, learn a new skill, or just kind of upskill. And
right,
as a magazine editor, you can provide that, and finding the right person to get across those skills and to be able to teach them in a constructive, practical way is part of my job. Mm-hmm. But also I need to get people to want to read them. So I have to fill the magazine not only with good instruction, but also look at the latest blockbuster, whatever it might be.
But do you think people go to the magazine? So they go to the magazine, a lot of them, for education, right?
Yes.
And they're hoping to learn, obviously, from the tutorial.
Yep.
So you have to have a roster of people who can do tutorials for you, or you just find people, hey, can you do a tutorial on this aspect, right?
Sometimes it's like that. Sometimes I'll be on ArtStation, for example, and I'll go, wow, that's an amazing piece of art. I want that in my showcase section.
Awesome.
And I'll talk to the artist and I'll say, look, I'm from 3D World. I would really like to have this. Mm-hmm. Can you answer a few questions? And our showcase section is the first kind of 8 pages of the magazine.
Right.
And that's where our reader art or our kind of community art comes from.
Okay.
Sometimes someone will come back and they'll answer the questions. I have like a set list of questions, mm-hmm, just to kind of find out a little bit about them and how they work.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people will come back with, you know, 3 sides of A4, and they just love to share what they do. And some people are particularly good at sharing what they do.
Right.
And that's a way of finding an incredible tutorial creator.
Tell me an example of one of the artists that you can think of that's been really great for you guys.
So Glenn Southern, mm-hmm, is an incredible artist. He has lots and lots of skills. Currently, he's on a bit of a virtual reality mission.
Uh-huh.
And he's doing some fantastic work with Oculus, which I didn't know about. I knew him as a ZBrush sculptor,
right?
Which he is brilliant at as well.
Mm-hmm.
But he's now taken this leap, and I saw some of the work he'd done, and I was like, Glenn, can you just come and talk to me about it? And
we chatted,
and he showed me some stuff, and he actually gave me a live demo, and he gave me a live tutorial, and I was a bit like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
I need to get this in.
Uh-huh.
And we kind of discussed ways of showing how to create inside that virtual space, but on a printed page,
uh-huh,
which could have been disastrous, but actually worked really, really well.
Awesome.
So that's a prime example of how it works.
Wow. And there's got to be a way to sort of break that down in a way because you guys do it in printed form, right? As opposed to someone on YouTube just showing you something, right? So there's got to be a way to convey that information, because I've seen it. I mean, the you know, you can see all the screen captures, and it reads really well. And I think that's an important part of the process of showing a tutorial inside of a magazine is kind of a challenge in itself, right?
It is. We do also, all of our all of our tutorials generally have a video to accompany them, and that will go on our online presence as well. And it could be on YouTube, it could be on Creative Block. Mm-hmm. We have a few avenues for that, or on our digital editions, we can embed videos and things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's not possible because English might not be the person's first language, or they just not set up. And because these are remote contributors, they might not have the gear to record a screen capture, whatever. But when we can, we do, because mm-hmm. I think it's important. And I think when it comes to the education, that something people forget is that your audience doesn't all learn in the same way. So some people learn much more from being directed, and they will sit there and they will press the buttons themselves and they'll be told what to do. Mm-hmm. Other people want to read a set of instructions and they'll remember it and then they'll try and work it out themselves.
Right.
Other people want to be spoon-fed. Mm-hmm. Other people prefer to be shown, and they would rather kind of sit back, look mm-hmm. over your shoulder. So having different methods of instruction in the magazine is quite useful for helping as many people as you can.
Right.
So we have the step-by-steps, we have Q&As, which are kind of short, digestible nuggets of information, which are about specific problems rather than a workflow. And then we have the practical content inside of our features, which is something I'm kind of on a bit of a push for. So as a magazine, I think 3D World has always had kind of the feature content being kind of the fluff behind the film. So there is some visual effects information in there, mm-hmm. and we always interview the VFX soups and whoever it might be for any given project. But you look at Planet of the Apes, and I know I've spoken to Joe Lettieri, mm-hmm. and I've talked to him about how he's done specific things. And I'm a bit like, why don't we put this in the magazine? Because this is great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm on a bit of a drive to get the writers, whoever it might be, myself or a freelancer, to mm-hmm. try and get some practical from the studio that made the film, the actual talent.
Right.
And in that particular example, we can get render breakdowns. So you can have render layers and you can see the buffers that were used and how they're composited together.
Right.
So it's not a step-by-step because, you know, Weta don't have time to give me a step-by-step and to give me one of their artists or a whole department to do that. But we can get the information in a useful way, which can then spark a reader to say, ah, so they used this technique. Now I can go and research that technique and I can find out somewhere else how to get the step-by-step. So you're kind of inspiring that kind of, I'm not really sure how to describe it, but you want people to just be excited about a project and to then want to adapt those techniques to their own work.
Absolutely. Which is interesting because it made me realize, of course, that you have to understand a lot of this. So you as a person runs this, you really have to understand 3D. On top of that, you have to be able to have good public relations with people. Then on top of that, you have to be a good writer and you have to be able to foresee all this. How did you develop all these skills to do that? And where did it start for you?
Okay, so I started out personally as a photographer.
Okay.
Which moved over a few years into CG,
mm-hmm.
Just from kind of image editing. And that was, you know, in the 90s, that was all Photoshop work.
Right.
And then by the mid 90s, I was on an Amiga in Lightwave.
Okay.
Doing set extensions and whatever. And then my love just kind of developed more into CG. So I've been a 3D artist. I have my own animation studio.
Uh-huh.
And I do a lot of motion graphics work.
Right.
I've been involved in a few quite fun projects for the likes of Red Giant.
Right.
The Plot Device movie. Uh-huh. I created the massive UFO in that film.
Awesome.
A few things like that. So I have a background which allows me to understand the technology and the terminology.
Right.
And people have asked me this before, and I always use the kind of photography analogy.
Photography is a great tool because, I mean, essentially for, you know, for, I try to explain it, especially on the rendering side of things, it is like photography. It is photography, right? So that's what we do is we just try to recreate photorealistic content, and that's by knowing how camera works, right?
Well, there's that, but there's also the way of explaining the technology. So you can put someone who is very good at PR or writing or finding the right contributors, which is the biggest thing for me.
Right.
As the magazine editor, finding the right contributor is the key.
Okay.
But when you're talking about technology, if you hand someone a camera, they know how to use it. Mm-hmm. Or it's not instinctively, but it may as well be because it's so ingrained into what we do and how we live our lives in our society. And you can say, well, you press the shutter button, and everyone will know exactly what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll say, well, you point the lens at the subject, and everyone knows. But if you say to someone, yeah, well, is that a subdivision surface?
Mm-hmm.
Or is that a NURB? Mm-hmm. And people look at you like, what's a NURB?
What is that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So there's a level of assumed knowledge that you can't take for granted for visual effects artists.
Yes.
No matter what field they're in, because a lighter will understand V-Ray, and they'll understand a lot of the terminology. And when you're looking at a camera, virtual or physical, you know, an f-stop's an f-stop. Everyone knows what an aperture does they're in that area. But there's you have to be aware of the risk of using too much kind of specific jargon.
Right. But do you think that that's, I mean, and how do you guide that for your contributors? Like, what do you say? There's like, you know, you got to make it more general, or how do you do that? What's the role of the editor in this process?
I think this is where the assumed knowledge comes in.
Okay.
You have to assume that somebody that is buying 3D World magazine has at least an inkling about what's going on and will be able to infer from what they do know what the terminology that they don't maybe understand means.
Right.
And I think that's fair.
Kind of like someone who's buying an automotive magazine has a little bit of an idea what torque and horsepower means.
Exactly. Right, yeah, exactly that. So they might not know what a sub-D is, but they'll understand what smoothing would be.
Right.
And making the leap from one to the other is that's the responsibility of the reader.
Right.
But it's our responsibility to make sure that leap is as small as possible.
Now, how long has the magazine been around?
I think it's about 12 years now.
Well, that's pretty big. Yeah, that's been along for a while.
I could probably work it out. We're on issue 2, 3, 4 is in production at the moment.
Okay.
So,
it must
be 12.
And you guys come out monthly, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And used to be back in the day, you guys would have like a CD or DVD that would be attached to it. I guess you guys don't do that anymore.
Those were the days. But no one has, you know.
No, I don't have. I don't have a drive in here.
No, exactly.
So now you can just put everything online.
Yeah, we have a vault.
So how does it? Because it's still a printed magazine. We get it. It looks great. But how do you feel that the idea of printed magazines work now? Do you guys?
It's on the up.
It's on the up.
I think there is a massive drop.
Why is that?
Because partly nostalgia.
Really?
And partly, I think, because the internet has become so vast and so swamped in information, good and bad, that I think some people go, you know what, this is my passion, this is my life or my job, this is what I really want to do. I would love to have a shelf of information that I can go back to.
But do you think there's also the point of like, you know, because if I'm browsing, let's say some blog site or whatever, I'm going to read a little bit sometimes, just a little portion of the blog, whatever, move on. And with a magazine, it's like, nope, I'm giving this the time that it needs, and I'm going to sit down and read this thing or take it on a plane or do whatever, which I think is great. Yeah, it's really interesting that magazines are doing that. So what are the different types of people? Obviously, like you say, you're constantly fishing for stories. You're constantly looking at ideas. What are some of the things that you do? You mentioned ArtStation as one of the places where you find some art and you want to get a story of it. But where are some of the other places that you explore and find ideas from?
I guess part of my role is having a network of people. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that that's part of the reason I was offered the job.
Right.
It's because I've known you for a few years now. And I've met and know lots of people from different areas of the industry who I can draw upon, like I did with the whole opinion piece about digital humans. I can come to you and I can say, look, you're the perfect person. You have the skills and you're in the right area to talk about this. I'm not.
Okay.
So it's about me knowing enough people and using that network to kind of inform myself before I can then share that information.
Yeah, I find it really, I think it's great because I'm in a very much in a similar most of you, I actually don't know as much as I know the right person to answer
exactly.
question.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a skill set that I think is, you know, is important, because what I like about what I do in labs is that I can find enough people to connect the dots to make something. And I'm sure, Yvonne, you create a story.
Yep.
You find enough, like, okay, we get all these things together and we get a great story to come out of it. Yep. And I'm noticing it even in this conference, right? This conference is pretty interesting because you're connecting a lot of dots to make lots of
hence why it's called Vertex.
Right, that's why it's called, now I get it.
Yeah, I came out with that name on day one when we started discussing it. I was like, well, it's got to be called that because we're bringing everybody together and the Vertex is
the Vertex, yep. Yeah, that's a really, now I get it. That's a really great name and I think it's really interesting. So let's... You said you mentioned you want to bring this obviously to the UK. What were some of the, you know, for a broader thing, view of the area, what were some of the things or challenges that you had to do this right now? Besides the fact that you did it in a really short time.
Yeah, we put it together quickly. It was like 5 months, I think, we put this together.
Wow.
It's, you know, it's a 12-hour day.
Right.
And, you know, so where you've seen yourself, the rooms are rammed.
Right.
We've got two workshops running concurrently and a third in the free expo area.
Right.
And so there's a lot going on. And, you know, the workshop rooms are 150 seats each.
Right.
And we've got VR.
You've got almost 800 people here so far.
Yeah. It's been incredible. So I think having a team that were excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
So Carrie and I obviously wanted to do it.
Right.
And the editorial part of Future is really keen on it.
Right.
Future as well also is very interested in creating events for our brands.
Okay.
So that's
What is Future, and explain exactly how the relationship works with Future and obviously with 3D Artists. They both manage 3D Artists and 3D World, right?
So how does it work? Future owned 3D World from the start.
Mm-hmm.
And 3D Artist was owned by Imagine Publishing.
Okay.
Down in Bournemouth, and they were a smaller privately owned publishing house.
Okay.
And Future bought them, I think, a couple of years ago. It was I wasn't there at the time. Mm-hmm. So I've had two stints at 3D World.
Okay.
I was there maybe 5 to 6 years ago as a technical editor,
mm-hmm.
where my sole responsibility was the training content and reviews.
Got it.
I came back not far off a year ago now, actually, I think maybe 10 months or so, as the editor. And in that space, with me being away, Future had bought Imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And they did all their corporate shuffling, anything that needed doing, and the two have just kind of settled.
Right.
3D Artist and 3D World, we're in the same room.
Right.
We don't share resources in the way of designers and things, because we have our visual styles are quite different, our design styles and, mm-hmm. you know, the house style and everything is a bit different.
How would you describe the differences?
I think this is a hard one, and I think while I was away from Future, I was writing for both titles.
Right.
And at that time, I felt that 3D World was the place for slightly heavier, longer, more in-depth content,
mm-hmm.
whereas 3D Artist was much more, it's kind of more welcoming, more approachable, and probably suited people lower down the career ladder.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure that quite so true now. I think we're maybe slightly nearer to each other, but... That's probably for the readers to answer.
Okay.
I'm probably too close to it to understand the differences. We share. I know we have contributors like I was who write for both titles.
Right.
And the content that comes out the end, once it's been through all our processes and editorial and production, can be quite different. But it's a nice fit. Again, we put this whole event on together.
Right.
And we, you know, we did our welcoming speech together, Carrie and I, on the stage. And like she said, it's a cool thing to have us together. Because I think from the outside, it probably looks like we should be rivals.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, think about it this way, right? You guys can compliment each other and learn from each other and grow with each other. As one of you learn something, you guys can learn from it and contribute to that. I mean, the way I see it is, like, you know, a lot of people thought it was completely confused when Chaos Group bought, you know, the Corona guys, right?
Yeah.
But the fact is that they don't realize that we were working together for almost a year before that even was announced.
Right.
And we both benefited from this, right? And this thing, you know, they were able to learn from stuff that we'd done, and we were able to learn from stuff that they'd done. And We serve slightly different markets, right? I mean, yes, we were somewhat competitors, but not really, because our markets were a little bit different focus. And I think the same is, like you were mentioning, 3D Artist has a slightly different tone to it, it sounds like, than 3D World, which is also kind of makes sense. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think so. And also, the industry is so small. It's such a niche, if you're thinking global terms.
Right.
The pool of talent that's out there, although there are a lot of very clever people, is actually reasonably limited.
Right.
And there's no need for us to both be fighting over which artists we want to talk to or feature in the magazine or have write for us.
Right.
They can do both.
Right, of course. Well, that's in terms... Now, this is an interesting point, because that's in terms of the people you're drawing from to get all these stories. Now, of course, the nice thing about visual effects is that these stories are generally very exciting stories. They're compelling. It's wonderful to be able to do that. But what you're the audience you have is much broader than that, because it's generally a lot of people who want to get into this very sexy industry and want to do that kind of stuff. So you have a responsibility to showcase it as people. You know, it's like people who back in the 70s used to get, you know, makeup effects magazines or stuff like that. And this is kind of the next step of that, right? What are some of the other outlets? You guys mentioned, obviously, Creative Block, right?
Yeah, so Creative Block's our kind of online home. 3D Artist, because it came from a different publishing house, has its own website and its own kind of user galleries and things, which is really cool. We have Creative Block. We're also quite active on social media.
Right.
I would like to be doing more editorial content socially. I think that would be quite a nice thing to explore.
So how would that differ? How does editorial social content differ from the sort
if
of
you look form? At a, let's just take Star Wars for example, because we're watching it earlier.
Right.
You open a Star Wars feature in a magazine and you might have 6 to 8 pages of interesting fluff, but it's not quite the space to be giving you bite-sized nuggets that you can take in on the train or in the car. Yes, some people get out a magazine for a longer journey and they might read it. But what we can do online with Facebook or Twitter is we can say, you know what, we've got this really cool information. We'll tell you about it now, but you can follow the chain and you can go and read it at your leisure. So it's really good for that. Or it's also really good for giving a key technique. So for the training side of the magazine, we can say, well, this person's written this Q&A, which is really, really cool. And it's 4 steps. Now, you can't share 4 steps on Twitter, but you can say, use this command or this shortcut to ease your workflow.
That's really... Okay, because a lot of people look at social media as advertisement to go to the full piece, right? They want to try to drive traffic in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and we do that.
And you do that. But the idea of giving a snippet of a tutorial as a tweet is interesting. That's got to be a tough way to...
And again, this goes back to my working background as an animator and a 3D generalist.
Right.
When I built up my own YouTube channel... and my own Twitter following, which is, you know, I don't do enough with it. I'm guilty of being one of those people that's lapsed to Twitter. But when I was building up my brand and my recognition, I was doing a lot of work in Cinema 4D. Mm-hmm. And even now people come up to me and they're like, oh, you're the Cinema 4D guy. And I've had people come up to me and say, I know your voice from YouTube. But I built that up by giving useful information, not just here's my dinner.
Right.
Or look at my dog doing something daft.
Right.
And I've done that too. But I've always done you know what, here's a free video. And then in the tweet, I'll be like, I use this shortcut. It makes my life easy.
Right.
So Cinema 4D, here's one for all your listeners. Like Shift-C
gives
you access to any control in the software. You just start typing and the list of anything where those characters comes in. You can share that in a tweet.
You can share that.
And you should, because if you want people to trust your information, you need to let them know how you're going to provide it.
Right.
Because, you know, I've produced training DVDs, but I wouldn't want someone to just go out and buy them without knowing who I am and what I do and like my training style, because it's not for everyone.
Yeah.
So I think that's equally valid method of building a relationship with your readers as a magazine editor is by giving them tastes of what you do and not charging for it, because you shouldn't be, not for a little thing like that. But it's useful for them to understand your tone, your point of view, what your interests are and what you're going to share with them.
So it brings up something that I've been interested in, and something that honestly I've been fighting a little bit, and I want your opinion on this. And the role the press has in terms of conveying stories, and the competition they have for people's attention, right? And this is a big deal. Like, you got to get someone's attention in a tweet, in a Facebook post, or something, because people's attention is so short, right? Yeah. And what you were saying, what I like about the idea of the magazines coming back, because people are like, when you're reading a magazine, you're not looking at Twitter, right?
Yeah.
But you have to get people's attention. And something that I'm resistant of is the idea of headlines or things that are clickbait.
Yes.
Right?
The BuzzFeed of the VFX world.
The BuzzFeed of, like, you know,
yeah,
we tried this new feature in Houdini, and you won't believe what happened next. Like, the, no, don't do that, because I'm not going to click on that. But people do still click on that.
Yep.
And how do you create something that's a good title or a good compelling story without it feeling like clickbait in some way? What's your?
I think there's possibly room for those clickbait type posts.
Okay.
Because in any given day, we all have windows of time that we can spend consuming information.
Sure.
And that might be 10 minutes where we can sit down and we can read something a bit more meaty and a bit substantial.
Mm-hmm.
Or we might be just having, you know, waiting for the kettle to boil, whatever it might be, where we can just go, just
right,
see something very brief.
Mm-hmm.
And you may see a list that says, what are the 10 best pencils to have in your bag as an illustrator?
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, that's a bit clickbaity,
mm-hmm,
and it's probably quite good for sponsors, because they're hoping that they get those clicks through, and the advertisers will give revenue based on the clicks.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily negate the value of the content, because actually, if you're an illustrator, you might not have heard of all of these pencils, so actually that content might be quite valuable.
Yep.
So that's how I see it. I'm with you. I'm less likely to click on those kind of titles, but I do see in some cases how they're quite valuable.
Well, doesn't it come down to trust in
yes,
a lot of ways, right? Sure, you may have a title like that that I'm going to click, but I've gone to your site enough, or I've read your magazine enough that I trust you as content stuff,
yeah,
right? I'm not, I don't go to BuzzFeed every day, right? But for example, I do go, you know, to different CG sites during the day. And another example I'd go is I go to The Verge almost every day,
yeah,
like, right? It's a great site. Really, but they do write those things. They do. I mean, I just saw a title the other day that said, "Do cell phones cause cancer?" I was like, "Really?"
I know. And I love the Verge, but I hate their emails.
Yeah,
that come in, and their emails are all clickbait.
Oh, really? Because I don't subscribe to their emails.
Oh, don't, because you'd hate it.
Okay, but there is a responsibility, I think, that we have here, that you know, how do you get great stories and still find a way to make that trust, right?
Oh,
so you have to develop trust.
You do. So you have to be giving a substantial proportion of your content as good quality, not clickbait,
right,
content. But the flip side, and I kind of hate myself for even thinking about this now, because it's just not really in my way of thinking, but I guess you have to be able to pay for the good quality content. And sometimes that means you have to bow down in front of the advertisers who want their own kind of content,
right,
put out there, because that's where their value comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And I would much rather have the 10 pencils to have in your bag piece alongside and this is how you use those pencils to create this content.
I think you're being
than
like
neither.
10 pencils in your bag example is perfectly valid. I see what you mean by being by like clickbaity, and
yeah,
if that's as clickbaity as you get, which it probably is, then that's fine, because I don't, you know, do cell phones cause cancer?
Well, yeah, that's
that's a little bit different.
Maybe it's because my role at 3D World, I don't have content like that.
No,
and I wouldn't lead with a headline like
yeah,
that, because for that very reason. So maybe that's why I'm looking at it the way I am.
Well, the thing is okay, so. You know, obviously in labs, I have a blog post, and this is, and I'm asking these questions honestly to learn from you because I have to do a lot of writing, more than I ever thought I ever had to do.
Yeah.
And I had to know what was, you know, what kind of content works or whatever. And what I found it was interesting is that, you know, we did a lot of like oh, look at the amazing work that this thing does, whatever, and, you know, of some project. And it is great work, you know, or something on Game of Thrones or whatever. But suddenly I'll go down and I say, and I write down understanding the new blah, 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 and write a very technical piece about stuff.
Yeah.
If you went to a PR person or marketing person and you say, between like the visual effects behind Game of Thrones and understanding how an adaptive dome light works, which one do you think will get the most clicks? They would immediately assume that Game of Thrones will. Well, the fact is, no, it was about completely the other way around.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's information in the second one that seemed like solid information. It wasn't as marketing.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So I think that's the thing, right? So when you say 10 pencils put in your bag, yeah, that's practical information. You may be, you know, selling pencils, but at the same time, you're telling people, it's like a review, right? Like, hey, you know, this pencil works better than that pencil.
Yeah.
Do you guys do reviews as well, right?
We do.
You do review projects.
As you were talking to me then, I was thinking I should probably mention reviews, because reviews, I think, it's the area of the magazine where it probably get the most ethical questions.
Right.
But of course you're going to give it a good review because they give it to you. Well, that's not how it works.
No.
And there's a code of conduct for us as editorials to
right.
follow. And why would I do that? Because that's not going to stand me in any good stead for other people that might want to send me gear, because I've already said that their competitor's good.
Right.
So I really enjoy reviewing gear and writing reviews.
And have you actually given hard reviews on things? I mean,
well, this is what I was going to say. Right. So most of the
reviews...
You don't
have to mention any specific brands if you don't want to.
Right? No, no, I won't give any names, but I take the stand that I will give a... So our reviews are marked 1 to 5.
Okay.
I'll give 3s, 4s, and 5s. I think that if a product comes in and I look at it and it's only worth a 1 or a 2, that's not something that should probably go in a magazine. I think there might be space for it in like a group test, but not as a standalone, because I don't want to be giving readers information that doesn't excite them about their hobby or their
okay.
job.
Right. And you don't want to necessarily, you know, it seems to me like I'm just going to go back to The Verge as an example
yeah.
because it's a broader thing. Very rarely do you see review. They do 1 to 10 or something like that. Right. Very rarely do you see anything under a 5.
Yeah.
Right. Because I would think that like if someone gave me a product, it's like, this is fundamentally broken.
Yeah.
Then I have a responsibility as a reviewer to tell that to the product, and they can,
yes.
then I can say, okay, we can choose not to review this
yeah.
because I don't want to shame your product or whatever else you're doing.
Well, there's that kind of ethos is the same in employment law in the UK, at least.
In employment
you're
law.
Not allowed to give somebody that you've fired or doesn't work for you any longer for any reason,
mm-hmm.
you're not allowed to give them a bad critique if somebody, a future employer, comes to you and asks you about them.
Oh, as a reference.
Yeah,
you?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
You're allowed to not offer a reference.
Right.
But you're not allowed to give a bad reference.
Right.
So the potential employer can infer what they want from that.
Right.
And they can ask then the relevant questions. So I'm with you. I think that if something is broken to the point where you don't want to put it in the pages of a magazine, you need to go back to the developer and say,
yeah.
you know what, I just couldn't. And this has happened, and I'm not going to name any names, but
right.
I've had something come to me and I've had to say, you know what, it says it's supposed to work on my setup. Doesn't work.
Right.
And they have done the right thing and they've said, well, let us look at it and we'll come back to you when we've fixed that bug.
Right.
And, you know, things slip through beta testing. That's just the way.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I know for a fact, you know, I've tried things and they haven't worked.
Yeah.
I've had to, you know, give some feedback and then they suddenly work and like, oh, it changes everything. Yeah. Right. So you in fact do the people a service by giving them feedback as opposed to.
Absolutely. And it's like TripAdvisor, isn't it? It's,
right.
People are so quick to jump on the negatives. I don't want 3D World to be that place. I want 3D World to be a celebration of what's good about what we do.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, people don't realize that when they do. I mean, you can just read comment sections about anything, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And it's just so ridiculous sometimes what you hear people say. And
yeah.
Listen, I work for some company that makes a rendering engine, which is, it's like, you know, Shiites versus Sunnis sometimes. It's bad. It's like a religious war
yeah.
out there. And, you know, just, it got, I'll give you an example. When Corona and V-Ray, you know, joined forces, it just blew people's minds because they wanted to hate each other so much.
Yeah.
And there was no reason for it.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, it's kind of a shame because people are not necessarily being very fair to each other. And I think reviews are a great thing. Do those get good attention in your site specifically? Do you think the reviews are one of the, between reviews and tutorials, which ones do you think are the more popular things?
People come for the tutorials.
They do, okay.
But I think that the reviews are valuable.
Right.
Few pages that they get to.
Right.
I'm sure some people do. And we're doing a reader survey at the moment, so... You know, if we have this conversation next time we meet later in the year, which right. we should probably do because it would be interesting, I'll have all the results from this and I'll be able to tell you definitely what people are actually looking for, what they're asking for. I can break down, you know, what software they use, all that kind of stuff.
Great.
Their backgrounds, which I think will be quite interesting.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure it'll be quite surprising how many professionals are coming for training.
Right.
Because when you're in a job and you're doing something as a lighter,
mm-hmm.
you're not really thinking about modeling. You don't have time to think about modeling because you're spending 10 hours a day lighting.
Right.
But those people are so engaged in the community and the visual effects as a whole that they might be interested in modeling or they might want to branch out. So mm-hmm. having a cup of tea and sit back and read something that can just spark something else for them to think about
right.
and something else to learn is probably very valuable.
Absolutely. And I want to sort of think back to the concept of inspiration, right? I think the first time you and I met was at THU,
right? It was.
Yeah. Which has been a great event, and you and I, you know, we'll probably meet there again later this year, which I'm excited about. Do you think that inspiration, specifically aesthetic and personal inspiration, is something that is lacking a little bit? In the community?
Possibly. And I think this is probably due to the fact that we live so much of our lives online.
You couldn't you get that online?
You could, but
people
I think
just say, just show me how to do this. Just show me how to do that.
There's not a lot of cross-pollination either.
Right.
It's you go online, you do a search, you look at the thing, and then you leave.
Right.
I don't think there's a lot of clicking through. On YouTube, I think that's very different. Because when you go to watch somebody's video, no matter what the topic, you're presented, even in like theater mode, you're presented with other stuff that you might like. And most websites don't have that. And that's a really good feature to draw you through and become more interested in other areas that you might not have thought about.
Yeah, because you don't go into Google and say, show me something inspirational, right?
Exactly.
You show me, it's like, show me how to, you know, properly model a NURB surface.
My therapy is building guitars.
Okay.
I spend so much time in front of a monitor that I want to go away and make some sawdust.
Right.
And
wow. What kind of guitars?
All kinds, but mostly electric.
Mostly electric, okay.
Yeah, and it's become quite a thing. And I obviously then go, how do I do this? Because it's quite a complex process.
Right.
So I'll look online and inevitably I'll end up in front of YouTube.
Yep.
And I've sat there before.
Isn't it great? I mean, like my I had to change the headlights on my wife's car and I didn't know how to get to the bulb.
Yeah.
Just went on YouTube and looked it up and bam, there was like 7 results.
Exactly that. I wanted to learn how to cut slots in a nut properly and mm-hmm. accurately out of bone.
Mm-hmm.
And half an hour later, I'm looking at some guy telling me how to make a better workbench. Just because I go, firstly, the thumbnail is very clear. I know exactly what I'm going to learn. And I watch it. He was engaging. Mm-hmm. And I sat there for God knows how long watching this guy making mortise and tenon joints the old-fashioned way with chisels and hammers. And I was just like, okay, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So I did. I built myself a workbench. And I would never have done that if I hadn't gone to YouTube looking at nuts.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's so cool. That's so cool. All right. Well, let's talk a little about the future of Vertex. What do you think about it right now? Where do you think you're going to go? I know you're just like in the thick of it, so maybe it's too early to ask that question.
We're halfway through day one of year one. So, but I think the feedback I've had walking around from speakers, attendees, developers that are here, sponsors of the show, everyone is very happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it would be very easy for us to feel satisfied if two or 300 people turned up on year one.
Of course.
And we've sold 800 tickets. The place, all the workshops, the talks, they're all full to the brim.
Right.
And, you know, there are, as much as we've got some brilliant sponsors here and we've got some, the expo floor is full of some really cool stuff.
Yeah.
There are some names that are missing. So I think in the future, I would rather have a longer event. I'd go for a 3-day event and get everybody involved.
Right.
Because that's the whole idea of Vertex, is to bring everybody together, not just some people.
Well, the thing is also, like you said, there is a huge community in this country that can attend this, right? And the fact that you guys can in create an event in the last 5 months and get 800 people here to something they've never heard of, because it's never been around yet, is pretty outstanding. And I really appreciate that, and I think it's really cool. It's a great event. I think there is a lot to be said about that. And it's not to diminish any other event that
goes on. No, not at all.
Because I think there's these micro events that happen, right? So there's someone who's like, oh, I'm going to go to that. It's right around the corner. And I can do that and then still go to attend other events. Because, you know, the tickets to this event are not necessarily astronomical. They're very affordable. And that allows people to say, you know, I'm just going to take the day, going to get off work.
When we had the discussion about ticket prices, we started at a higher level. And then through the course of the meeting, we were a bit like, you know what? It's one day in London. Let's charge what would be a day out for a small family or, you know, an evening out if you were going to spend that cash.
That's great.
And that seemed like the most appropriate.
And you get people who are really going to like this stuff, right? Because I'll just give you another example. I'm not going to tell you the specific conference, but it was I had to buy a ticket for some reason that it wasn't going to give me one, even though it's a long, complicated story. I'm a little bitter about it. Let me just put it that way. But I had to buy the ticket. Luckily, my company paid for it. But $1,500.
Wow.
For a 2.5-day event.
Yeah.
That's a price that only corporations are going to pay, right? And that really limits your audience. That really is ridiculous to do that. And I think that there are a lot of the people, you know, it was great. I had the first talk today, which was awesome. And I had this young girl come up to me and she told me, like, you know, I've seen your talks and I've heard your podcast. I've seen this and that. And she was really inspired and she could approach me and say, what would you advise me to do to get into this field? What can you do that?
Yeah.
And, didn't cost her an arm and a leg to do that. And
it was probably free.
Might have been free.
Yeah.
And she was able to do that and find inspiration and meet people who she, you know, is inspired by or connected to or feels that, you know, could be a mentor for them.
Yeah.
And even as someone who's been to THU, again, I think has a very similar mentality to be, I'll just call it the 5-minute mentor, right?
Yeah.
Where you could give someone 5 minutes of your time and that could inspire them for as in terms of a direction for the next year or so. And
absolutely
hopefully do that.
Yeah. And also the accessibility is really important. I think that what we've done here. So yes, there's the I think it's £49 for the AAA ticket.
Right.
Where you get to see all of the talks and be at the panel discussion and the after show drinks and everything.
Right.
But you can come here for free and you can see the expo. You can do the Ask an Artist. So if you're stuck with a particular technique, you can come in. We've got guys from the Mill and Frame Store out there helping people fix their problems that they're having. I mean, there is no show that does that I'm aware of.
Right. Well, that's the other thing, right? Because you can get the guys from the Mill and Frame Store here pretty easily because all you're asking is them to take a day off work. Right.
Yeah, and they're, you know, a couple of miles down the road.
Right. So they're taking the day off work and they just come here and go like, okay, here, what can I do for you? You know, and that's great. I think there's something about the locality of this event being in London that's really important.
Yeah.
And that's a you know, a day off is great. And I think that's a really good idea. All right. Well, this is really cool. We're kind of rounding towards the end here, which is really great. I want to know if you can let people know more about the event where they can follow it. Obviously, are you recording some of these talks? Or
yeah, all of the talks are recorded.
Right.
I'm not 100% sure how that's going to be disseminated,
right?
But I'm sure it will be. But if you follow the hashtag VertexConf,
right,
as in conference,
right,
then that's where we're tweeting everything.
And, okay.
The VertexConf.com website will have all that information on there as well.
Okay, so people can follow that, obviously, for new, you know, for next year, we'll be able to see what's going on. So vertexconf.com and then hashtag vertexconf on Twitter is a good place to start to look
and the,
at things.
And the magazines, of course.
And the magazines. So we're obviously, you know, 3D World and 3D Magazine are available for subscription. You can get all that. And they're great magazines. Highly recommend them. Creative Block is another one as well.
That Creation Block, definitely. Right. And sign up for the newsletter. There's a vertexconf newsletter that you can access on the website.
Okay.
And I think that's probably where we'll let people know where they can see more.
Okay.
I would have thought. And I imagine we'll keep that domain going for future events as well. That's
great.
That would be my plan. That would be the sensible option.
Okay.
So, yeah, just keep an eye on the pages.
What about your work? What about your work?
My work?
Yeah, do you have your own? You said you don't keep up with your Twitter as much, but...
No, I don't. And I mean to. And actually, it's things like this where I go and I'll see Simon Holmedal doing crazy stuff in Houdini.
Right.
And now I'm kind of the back of my head, I'm going, right, I've got to go and work out how this
works. But, you know, see, one of the things I love about my podcast, I hate to say this, but you meet people and you talk to people and, like, you know, I'm sure a lot of people know who you are and they know, you know, because you network just as I do. But I bet you very few people knew that you made guitars, right?
No, I'm sure nobody does.
Nobody does. So I'm sure people are going to say, can I see one of Rob's guitars? So, like, pictures and stuff.
I have a whole different Instagram account for doing that kind of stuff.
Isn't that cool? So I mean, hopefully we can put that that link in
yeah,
the
it's,
podcast.
Yeah, it's Redman Amps.
Okay, so, there you go.
Because it started out, I built a tube amp. And that's how it came about. And somebody was like, well, if you can build an amp, you can easily build a guitar. So I was like, yeah, whatever. And then I did.
I had a friend of mine who I work with, actually. He was a CG artist as well at Gensler. And he made things. He was an incredible guy who just made things out of whatever he could find. And he would build things out of high-tech junk all the time. He made a telescope out of parts of an Apache helicopter and stuff like that.
Like you do. Yeah.
Yeah. But he started getting guitars as well. And he was making them out of random, like, leftover pieces of wood from, like, kitchen counters and stuff like that. Because you could get, you know, like, really beautiful pieces of wood. And he's like, how am I going to build this? And
yeah, there's a guy in San Francisco who started building skateboard guitars. So the bodies were all made out of multiple laminated skateboards.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And they're pretty cool.
Yeah. That's a great, great thing. Well, this has been cool, and we want to put all those links up for people to follow. And it's been really great to be here at this event. I know you still have a lot more to go, so I don't want to take up too much more of your time.
No, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Rob. It's been great. Cheers. Thank you.